So I'll speak about interaction and local storage and private data analysis. My name is Adam Smith. This is based on joint work with a few people, and I'll mention them as I go. I was a postdoc at Weizmann. I'm now a person of unclear status here at ICANN. Sofia Rasputnikova and I will be joining the faculty at Penn State in a couple of months. And just as a quick plug, we have money and space for grad students and visitors, so send us your talented undergrads and come see us. And yeah, this is of course part of the IPAN workshop on topics vaguely related to work privacy. So this talk is about basically the same model that Kobe was talking about, and really the goal is to kind of take a microscope to the model and really try and understand what's going on. So we'll start, we'll use this kind of indistinguishability-based definition that Kobe went through. And again, I won't try to justify the definition, but there is a sense in which these definition, this notion of privacy is necessary to handle arbitrary auxiliary information handed to the adversary. And so, and Cynthia will talk about this in more detail, so I won't say more than this, that this is I think a natural and important notion, and it does deserve to be investigated carefully. So what I'll talk about are kind of limits on the kinds of communication patterns that one can allow in these types of protocols. And specifically, I'll look at two classes of protocols, non-interactive protocols, and what I call local protocols. I'll define them both in a minute. But the picture that emerges looks something like this. If this is the world of all private protocols in the kind of Barney the Dinosaur purple, then if I've got some subclass of protocols that are local, which is basically each person's private information never leaves their computer, some other subclass of protocols which are non-interactive, then there are points that are in the yellow region and there are points that are strictly in the blue region. So these kind of concepts are incomparable, so we get at least four kind of clearly separate classes. All right, so what do I mean by interactive? An interactive protocol, you know, for this audience, it doesn't take too much imagination to figure what it is. There's some protocol for collecting and sanitizing or anonymizing or whatever, making the data private, and users, be they researchers, whoever, you know, evil zombie doctors, they ask questions to the protocol and get back answers, you know, maybe sometimes you ask a question, you get an answer that they tell you no, sometimes you ask a question, you get lots of noise, who knows, but you ask a sequence of questions adaptively, and so you don't need to know ahead of time exactly what you want to know, you sort of, online as you're going, you sort of look at the answers you have, and you use your intuition or whatever to figure out which question to ask next. A non-interactive protocol, in contrast, the model looks something like this. The data is collected and analyzed, and then, you know, whatever the results of that analysis are just published once and for all. You know, maybe they're on CD, maybe they're on the web, maybe they're printed in the newspaper. Just an example, you know, so both of these are out there. So non-interactive, like I said, you know, it's the common model. An example of an interactive thing is the U.S. Census, where you can sort of ask for statistics kind of block by block of, you know, you can ask for block-level statistics from the U.S. Census interactively on their website, census.gov. So, you know, non-interactive protocols, they allow for easier distribution. Obviously, you know, you don't have to worry about communication, you just disseminate the information in the usual way. In some sense, it's more secure because what you can do is you process the data and then you don't have to keep it around, you can just erase it. And that's, you know, very useful for, from a computer security point of view. And essentially all the work in statistics and data mining, and there's a rich literature on these general topic, pretty much everything is non-interactive. And even the interactive solutions are often illusory. For example, that census website is basically, there's one database that it's actually asking questions of. Okay, so, you know, it's interaction in that case is just convenient, so you don't have to get all the information at once. But it's not actually used in a meaningful way. And just as a note, this is not necessarily true of the recent work in the cryptography community, stuff along the lines of what Kobe was talking about. It's not necessarily interactive. I mean, it's really interactive. That it uses interaction in a key way, and this is exactly I realize the bullet is kind of ambiguous. Well, even the not saying not necessarily true is such a non-committing statement. Anyway, it's certainly safe. Okay, so what do I mean by local? So that's what interactivity is. Everybody gets it. What do I mean by local? Well, rather than having Alice, Bob, and whoever sort of give their data to the trusted census organization and just believe that they'll take care of it, perhaps they're a little cagier, and really what they'd like to do is hang on to their data themselves and just, when the user asks a question, he's sort of asks the question to each person. Each person individually answers provides some data, and then the user sort of aggregates these information in such a way that whatever comes out of each person's little box is actually private. So each person has a guarantee that whatever leaves their hard drive is okay. In contrast, you can imagine a centralized model where, it all gets sent to one big computer somewhere in Maryland, and then, it's processed, and then you talk to the computer.
So I understand. How can it be that in a local case? So Alice sends directly to the user. What do you mean it's private? How can it be private? I mean, the user then needs to
You'll give an example.
Here, we'll see some examples.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, just as a point, where does secure function evaluation fall into this? Well, secure function evaluation maybe would give you a way, based on computational assumptions or other types of assumptions, of emulating this model in this model. But and I'll come back to that at the end of the talk. But for now, we'll leave the secure function evaluation aside, and we'll come back to it.
And in the local case, can Alice and Bob and me talk to each other, or only to the user? The interaction is all through the user.
Yeah.
But it's easy, right, to fix. You encrypt everything that you send to the sanitizer, so you can via the sanitizer establish a private key and potentially talk. So.
Well,
it's really, really off the point.
So in the local model, the advantage, of course, is that there's no central trusted party interacts individuals directly with the untrusted user. You hang on to your own data, and almost all the work in the data mining community, especially, fits this model. In fact, typically it's both local and non-interactive. And an example, the sort of canonical example is randomized response. Someone knocks on your door with a survey, and they're going to ask some sensitive question, do you have AIDS? So rather than, because you might not want to tell them, they'll give you a spinner that with probably two-thirds tells you to answer randomly. So with probably one-third it says answer yes, with probably one-third it says answer no, and with probably one-third it says tell the truth. Okay, so this is an example. So you spin the dial, you answer according to the dial, and you spin it again and hand it back to the census taker. That's an example of randomized response. Obviously, it works better when done by computers than by people. Okay, so this is the picture that emerges from the talk. We've got sort of all the world of all protocols, centralized, including centralized and interactive, and then sort of local protocols and non-interactive protocols. And the point of this talk is that when the data is even somewhat rich, meaning that each person has more than a handful of possible values he can have, I'll specify it, then basically these models are incomparable. There are things that lie in the yellow and things that lie in the blue. So outline for the talk, I'll recap the definitions just so I can try try to be formal. We'll look at two types of queries that'll provide the separation. Some queries which lie over here, rank queries, matrix rank over Z2, which lies over here. So I'll first give protocols that show they're in the respective regions, then impossibility results that show they're not in the intersection, and then at the end I'll try to kind of recap and give some perspective on what these results tell us. Okay, so here's a basic setting. We've got a database, some sanitization, whatever, anonymization algorithm. There's some interaction with users. This generates a transcript. And I think of the database as a table of n rows, each in some domain D. D can be anything, but for this talk, imagine D will be the set of bit vectors of length little d. Okay? And we'll use little d to somehow measure the complexity of the data, how rich it is. So we'll get separations when the number of points in the database is less than some exponential in d. So the x of d for this talk means not e to the d, but 2 to the c times d for some constant. Okay. So unless you have exponentially large amounts of data in your dimension, then basically you're in trouble. So typical census form is 7 pages, a few hundred questions, so you wouldn't have hard drives to fit all this type of information. More time to write it down. Okay. I wanted to say, you can think, if you really want to be literalist, you can think of these bits as yes, no questions asked to a person, but the talk will be more abstract. Okay, so the definition of security is if I take any two databases which differ in a single entry, a single record, then the distributions on transcripts should be close within some distance epsilon. And what does that mean more formally? Well, if I take the process is epsilon indistinguishable, if for all A is now an adversary, so this is a notation switch from Kobe's talk, for all adversaries asking questions interactively, and for all pairs of databases which differ in a single row, and for all sets of possible transcripts which arise, the probability that the transcript under X lies in the set is that almost can be only a little more than the probability that the transcript under X prime lies in the set. And what's kind of important is that the epsilon in this definition sort of has to be non-negligible by a simple hybrid argument. Okay, so we have to kind of wrestle with situations where there is information being leaked, otherwise you're not getting any information at all, but it's somehow controlled by this parameter epsilon. And because we're proving lower bounds, it will sort of allow as much flexibility as possible, will allow some additive error of delta, which is assumed to be negligible. Okay, so this is the definition. This is the definition which we'll show is unattainable in some cases. So as I said, here's the picture. If the data is rich, that is, if the number of points is less than roughly 2 to the d over 4, then there exist data mining tasks which lie in each of these regions. And specifically, we'll look at online sum queries to provide an example of a point here, and matrix rank over Z2 to provide an example of a point here. And as I've said, these models require so what we're looking at are restrictions on the model that would hopefully make things easier to implement or somehow more practical. And the takeaway message from the talk is that these models require gigantic amounts of data to answer all and to do everything we want to do. Okay, so what's the strategy? I'll define these two types of queries more exactly. Give private protocols that show where they lie in the picture and online, and then impossibility results, and maybe for ease of remembering where we are, these are local protocols, so this is sum. These are non-interactive protocols, so this is rank. This is what where most existing solutions in the data mining literature lie, and this is sort of the general stuff, and this is in particular where truck more or less lives. Okay.
I think having something there, doesn't it already show that neither of these are sufficient, if there's something outside of either of them?
You have to prove that
well, you have to prove that it's outside.
No, no, something where you said Kobe's tongue.
Well, okay, that's, I mean, we have to, so, you know, let's pretend that until we get to, you know, slide 20 or something, you don't know where, you know, where this dot goes. It goes somewhere in the ball, but, you know, does it go here? Does it go there?
Oh, so your result, what you're talking about is also a dot out there? I thought you just had two dots.
It'll come, I mean, if...
Oh.
Okay,
I'll
ask for
it. An algorithm used interaction. And
so it'll turn out, so it'll come out of the talk that,
okay.
It'll come out of the talk that, you know, that framework gives you both of these things.
Okay.
We'll see. All right, so, well, somehow I jumped forward. Right, oh, okay, good, good, good. So, so what do I mean by some queries? Well, Kobe kind of talked about these anyway. So we've got some, think of the query from the user. And so it's, think in a sort of interactive style model, the query from the user consists of some little function, f star, which takes an index and some data, and it's just a predicate on the index and data. So it returns a bit. And now the function is just the sum of the f stars over all the points in the database. So, you know, how many points satisfy the predicate? So this captures natural counting tasks, a number of linear algebra type things, and, you know, surprisingly, Blum et al. Showed that it captures a bunch of other seemingly much more complicated data mining tasks. That if you can sort of ask sequences of queries like this, then you can do these. Okay, and rank over Z2, well, as Kobe said, take the input, view it as a matrix, so each person's data provides a row of the matrix, and where these are over 0, 1, and now think about computing just the rank of that matrix. And yeah, so these are the two things we'll look at. So how do we do? I want to show you that some queries lie somewhere in this ball. So here's a local protocol for doing some queries. What does the user do? User wants to know this little predicate f star, just broadcasts it to everybody, tells everybody f star. And now each person individually computes their predicate, so they get a bit, either 0 or 1. They flip the bit with probability a half minus epsilon and broadcast the answer, just, you know, send it back to the user. Okay, so that's what he did to answer Yael's question. This is, you know, something you can do. All right, now, why is this an even reasonable thing to do? Well, if you limit yourself to asking at most t queries, then essentially you're adding noise in some sense, roughly square root of t over epsilon in each of these little yellow balls. And by the law of large numbers, the total noise you're adding is about square root of t times n over epsilon, so it's still sublinear for interesting parameters. And the point is this is local, and that but it's really somehow interactive. Users can really choose their queries online. It's not that there's no single time beyond which the user, you know, can no longer change his mind. Okay, so how do we do rank in a, now in the other ball, a sort of centralized and non-interactive protocol for rank? So again, we're back in the centralized model. We view the input as a matrix, and the point is that rank has sensitivity 1, as Kobe tried to convince you. If you're changing one row in a matrix, you can at most increase the number of the maximal size of a linearly independent set by 1. And of course, you can at most decrease it by 1 because you're not changing those k minus 1 other vectors. So that's why it has sensitivity 1. And so you can release it with noise that's basically, we can add noise that's basically constant in n. And in particular, you know, we should be able to distinguish database matrices with rank, let's say d, from matrices with rank, let's say d over 2. Okay, that's sort of a minimal thing we should be able to do, but you know, you can actually do much better.
So then I'm sorry, when you say noise, you mean like every component, every bit you add noise? I'm sorry, what is the noise for the matrix?
You compute the rank, which is an integer.
Oh, just send the number. To the rank you add.
Okay, so that's the protocol. Great. Yeah?
On the previous example.
There's some?
Yeah, considering that the aggregation happens after the, so the user sees each individual answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the point, actually. Is that individually each answer has to be safe. That's what the local model means.
But this doesn't seem safe, because the user knows my bit with high correlation, with high probability, right? All others.
Yes, that's it's a sad thing that, so high correlation meaning non-negligible. So I'm adding noise, so I'm flipping each bit with probability roughly a half minus epsilon over square root of t. So it's not that much information. 51%. So Kobe didn't mention it, I sort of said this earlier, but basically by a hybrid argument, you can show that in these types of protocols, centralized or otherwise, you're always going to get sort of non-negligible leakage of information. And Cynthia will show a more interesting version of that statement. Okay. So now what I'd like to explain is how do you actually separate these models. And I'd like to convince you that somehow online sums require interaction and that rank requires some kind of centralized protocol. Okay, so we can state the results more formally. If n is less than, I stated these for the case that epsilon is less than 1. In fact, it holds for even for epsilon an arbitrary large constant. So if epsilon is 100, that's also okay. It's meaningful and okay, but let's just look at the simple case. For basically any interesting level of privacy, if n is not exponentially large in the dimension and not polynomially large in this negligible parameter delta, then there exists some distribution over some queries, f star, such that for any non-interactive algorithm, for almost all of the sum queries, with high probability over sum queries, the distribution on inputs where no entry satisfies the predicate is indistinguishable from a random database such that all entries satisfy the predicate. Okay, so this is about as strong a separation as a statement as we could make. You're getting no information. This wiggle here is statistical distance exponentially small, in D. Okay, so this is about as strong a separation as we could possibly hope for, at least for these types of queries. And obviously it has to be with high probability, because if I pick ahead of time, pick one particular sum query, some small set of sum queries, I can answer those non-interactively if I choose them ahead of time. But the point is, once I publish the data, all bets are off. Okay, so basically what this means is these mechanisms must be tailored to answer very specific classes of functions. And unless you've got absurd amounts of data, the point is that when you've got exponential amounts of data, you can just reconstruct an extremely accurate picture of how your data is distributed. And so, these results are at least qualitatively tight. If you've got, large, 2 to the some other constant times d, then you can sort of answer anything you want. Okay, so that's the first statement. That's from a TCC paper from this year, Dork, McSherry, Nissim, and myself. The second statement is that if I've got any local private data analysis protocol, which uses a sub-exponential number of rounds, then, again, a similar picture. If I take a random matrix of rank d over 2 versus a random matrix of rank d, then these things are indistinguishable, again, with exponentially small statistical difference. And so locality is very restrictive. Now, in this statement, it's more clear than in the other statement, but in this statement, it should be clear to this audience anyway that we're really using these kind of information theoretic definitions heavily. Because if I allow crypto, then under reasonable assumptions, you could build a multi-party computation protocol which sort of simulates a centralized party. But then, you know, you run into obviously other problems. And there's a paper on this by at Eurocrypt this year by Dor Kantapadi, Mironov, McSherry, and Naor. And you can read that paper if you're interested in the last two words of the slide. Okay. So the proof idea, the proof is actually almost the same for both separation results. So intuitively, both separations are going to be based on some sort of linear algebra over GF2, and the kind of core idea in both proofs is identical. Oh, I forgot to mention. I'm sorry. The W, the N is Kobe, and the W is Anat Weinreb, who is somewhere around here. There he is. He's a student. He's a postdoc at the Technion, right? Or will be. So if you have open postdoc positions. Okay. All right. So the basic idea of the proof is now for each index I for between 1 and n, let's just look at what happens when we fix n minus 1 points in the database. Okay. So our definition of secrecy basically tells us, I'm ignoring delta in this slide. Our definition of privacy basically tells us that for any point z, or strictly speaking for any subset, the probability that z of y lands in equals z is at most twice the probability that z of y prime equals z. Okay, so that's the epsilon equals 1 definition. Right, so that's it. In fact, we'd hope to do better than this, but in particular the results will hold for this. Okay, so we've got this kind of, think of z now as some kind of channel, right, through which an individual user's information is being fed. Okay, and once I fix everybody else's data, I've sort of reduced to the local case in some sense, right? So the main lemma is that if I take a subset V in 0, 1 to the D, which is just a random linear subspace of dimension K, then with probability all but exponentially small in K, the distribution Z on a random point applied to a random point in V is exponentially close to the distribution Z applied to a random data point. So essentially this gives me sort of a class of predicates which are somehow difficult to estimate. Big V, this is big V. I think I increased the font size of the parentheses to make it sort of clear, you know, where the information is going. This is a big V. Looks like this. So this is the main idea, and this is some sort of, what is going on here? This is some sort of Chebyshev bound, now not on individual samples, but on distributions. So each y defines some distribution. They're known to be close. And I can think of v as pairwise independently sampling 2 to the k points y. Okay, and so what the statement is, when I do that, the average of the distribution, so this is just an average of distributions, this is another average of distributions. This one is the expectation of this one. And the point is the pairwise independent sample will converge very quickly to to its expectation.
What do you use about Z? Some small variance or something? This is the side.
Okay. So if you only had the restriction that these two distributions, Z of Y and Z of Y prime, were, say, close in statistical difference, you would get nothing here. Okay. So we're somehow, this is where the magic happens. Okay, so I'll prove this in a minute, but first I'll explain why it implies what we want. And this part is very straightforward. In fact, the whole thing is reasonably straightforward. All right, so suppose we've got some mechanism which is non-interactive, then we'll define a predicate as follows. We pick n vectors from the space 0, 1 to the n, and define my query, which is just the inner product mod 2 of the ith vector with x, right? So, you know, my background is in cryptography. You know, knee-jerk reflex when I hear predicate is, you know, Goldreich-Levin, and sure enough, it's the right thing to do. Okay. So so we define the corresponding subspace is just the space of vectors which are perpendicular to R, and this is essentially a random subspace of dimension d minus 1. So the what's going on? So we'll define some sort of hybrid argument. Remember, this is some centralized protocol, possibly centralized protocol. So what we'll do is we've got a different subspace of for every player that's actually crucial for the argument to work. And so now what we do is we sort of define a hybrid experiment where the first I minus one coordinates are chosen randomly from their V's. The last n minus I coordinates are chosen randomly from the whole domain, and this point is fixed to Y. And this lemma that I had on the previous slide, combined with a hybrid argument, shows that with all but exponentially small probability, each of the steps in the natural hybrid is small. Right? So we're going from an input where the predicates are all chosen to be zero, to an input where the predicates are all random. Okay. And now, by just the symmetric argument, the situation where all the predicates are one is also indistinguishable from the case where all the predicates are random. And so that gives us the even stronger statement that I can't distinguish the case when everything is zero from the case when everything is one. Okay, so here's a class of a class of predicates, and you can only answer you can answer at most an exponentially small fraction of them. Yeah.
What does it say about the amount of interaction? Is there a lower bound on the number of rounds?
So I think the right way to say it is that after the last round, you've made your choices. So if you stop anywhere in the middle, then you've still got options, right? So then it doesn't. So what's going on is that if you can choose the predicate online in an interactive thing, you can always ask for information specific to that predicate. But once the protocol is over, then it's over, and you're not getting sort of much more.
So I'm sorry. I guess I'm just missing the point. So what is the state of the statement? Is the database has the entire, is the sanitizer has the entire database of everything?
Mm-hmm.
You're saying he cannot compute approximate sums? I mean, that's, I guess I'm missing something.
So let's go back to the main statement. So the order of quantifiers is important. So what I'm saying is, so that you fix this distribution, which we've now seen,
right.
For any non-interactive, centralized mechanism, so I give you the database, you compute, and you publish something, okay? And you send it to you put it in the back pages of the New York Times or whatever, and now someone else comes along and says, oh, I've got a new question I want to ask. Well, unless you thought of their question ahead of time, you're in trouble.
Unless you answered that question.
Right. So you cannot publish sort of a single general purpose thing that'll allow them.
Arbitrary sum, what is meaning for arbitrary functions f?
Yeah. No, but even for a large fraction of them. You can't even do a large fraction.
Right, so you choose a specific distribution of functions for the cases you
want.
But what do you mean the order of quantifiers matters? This is the stronger statement, no? If you switch the order of quantifiers, this is what we want, right?
Yeah, what do I mean?
It would still be true if you switch them, but it would be less interesting. Or am I missing? I might be missing.
If you choose the query before the centralized protocol, then it doesn't make sense. No. So that quantifier we want. Yeah. No. I think this is, in terms of order of quantifiers, this is the strongest statement that would still be true.
Is that a variances f mentioned?
A who?
F. What's that?
The distribution.
So remember that F star was sort of the little predicate applied to each, and F was the sum of the predicates on all the. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. And these are the conditional things. And, so you fix itself, and then you choose x is equal to 0, and you choose itself.
Right, I mean, the proof really shows you what's going on, right? We choose random x on which the predicate is 0, or random x on which the predicate is 1. So why the analogous statement for rank should also comes out relatively easily from the way I've kind of set up the framework. So let's say distribution 1 is just a random matrix in 0, 1 to the d to the n. So I just pick each vector randomly. If n is bigger than, let's say, 2d, then with high probability, I'll get a matrix of full rank. And incidentally, if n is less than 2d, then you get even stronger bounds, but I don't care. The second distribution is now, so I need a distribution over matrices with rank d over 2. What's the natural way to do this? Well, pick a random subspace of dimension d over 2, and now just pick the entries independently from that subspace. And again, with high probability, this will have rank exactly d over 2, but it doesn't really matter for this one. And the point is now the adversary's job is given access to this kind of local privacy mechanism, possibly in multiple rounds, to distinguish an input drawn from distribution 1 from an input drawn from distribution 2. And what's crucial is the adversary doesn't know V. So he knows he's trying to figure out if the rank matrix has high rank, but he doesn't know where to look for the linear dependencies between the vectors. Okay, so now we break this protocol into rounds. So you can think, protocol 1, protocol 2, each consisting of each round of interaction where the user sends something to the to the people holding the data and they all answer him or her. And under the assumption that this number of rounds is, let's say, sub-exponential in the data, again, then once again, you apply the main lemma, and now with a random subspace of dimension, this should be a d over 2, I'm sorry, dimension d over 2, and again, a sort of hybrid argument. So in the first round, you learn nothing, right? So at the end of the first round, the adversary still doesn't know V, so he can't ask a question. The distribution on questions he asks itself cannot depend on V. So in the second round, he's not going to learn anything either. And now he has to choose a question for the third round, but again, he can't, tailor his question to V, so he's sort of stuck. And basically, unless he plays the game exponentially many times, he never learns anything about V, and in particular, will never be able to distinguish these two distributions. And notice this sort of, this hybrid argument is a bit different now. We're using the same subspace, the same subset for every individual, but we also have this kind of the additional trickiness of dealing with the multiple rounds. So you somehow need to build the kind of way the adversary is asking questions. You need to build it into the definition of the Z's, but it's given the ideas on the slides, it's not very complicated.
I forgot what is Z. Sorry, I thought I understood that.
Oh, so Z, remember, is Z is this.
Oh, sure.
Okay, so it's kind of, I actually said fix the I minus first coordinates, but actually it's fix a distribution on these coordinates, a distribution on these coordinates, and fix the ith component to Y. And that defines some, I don't know, I like to think of it as a channel now, which is somehow not leaking a lot of information about Y.
So these kind of transitives that grows over time, or?
Well, in the interaction case, Z would be the transcript at the ith. Z would be the ith person's contribution at the jth round.
Yes. So there are,
but again, there aren't too many of these Z's, so the hybrid argument goes through. Aren't too many, meaning sub-exponential. Okay. All right. So we've boiled things down to this relatively straightforward lemma. So we've got a channel which satisfies these conditions, and what we want to prove is somehow that if we sample the inputs independently, then the distribution on channel outputs converges fairly quickly to its expectation. Right? So again, more explicitly, what's the probability that z of v equals some particular value little z? Well, it's the sum over those points in v, which, I'm sorry, it's the expectation over points in v of this probability. And now because of pairwise independence, it's clear that the I'm ignoring this one point which isn't independent. It's the zero point, which is always there. Forget about it. It's not important. Because of pairwise independence, this says that the expectation of this thing goes to what it should go to. So we've got some kind of estimator. And really, the only step where we're using the property of the channel is to say that not only does the variance scale down with the square root of the size of v, that's the usual Chebyshev bound, but the important part is point by point, the variance is proportional to the expectation at that point. Okay, and this property would not be true in general if we just required, say, a small statistical difference between the channel output distributions. Okay, so here we're really using the ratio bound, and the point is that what's going on? Well, we have, we're sampling from some distribution which all my sample points lie between these two bounds. Okay, and now, usually we think of Chebyshev distribution as sampling numbers between 0 and 1. If we scale everything down, we can now scale everything down, and the variance really goes as proportional to this quantity. And the reason that's useful is that when we sort of apply Chebyshev, whatever, Markov bound to get an estimate on how far the estimator can deviate from its expectation, what we get is it'll be 1 plus or minus something exponentially small times the probability at z, which is the expectation. And so now when we sum the errors, well, we've this 1 plus expectation, 1 plus exponentially small factors out, and we've just got some bunch of numbers that sum to 1. Okay, and this is for most z, and there's some set of bad z's, but the set of bad z's is sufficiently small that they also contribute statistical difference at most exponentially small. So this is basically everything. We're done. Okay. Yeah, got a couple of minutes. I'll try to finish early. So what I've tried to do in the talk is kind of start painting a picture of the limits of what should be called indistinguishability style definitions, but which, as Cynthia will try to convince you in her talk, one can rename in a slightly different way. And by a result of Dork and Naor, this type of framework is somehow necessary for handling arbitrary auxiliary information. And so that is why I think it's worth spending the time to kind of start understanding the fine points of the model. So what we specifically did, separations based on the exact communication model, so local, non-interactive, intersection, everybody else. Maybe now at this point it's a good reason to point out why Kobe's talk is way up here, is that because using the framework Kobe described, you can do both sums and rank, so you're done. My co-authors tried to convince me not to put too much of this in, but I'll say it anyway. So the way I like to think about this result, yeah, they're just happy I have almost one slide on it. So the way I like to think of this result is to compare what you would get from a random sample of k points. Okay, so a random sample is necessarily very far from being private under our definition. So probability one, I'm telling you somebody's data. All right, and if the data is reasonably rich, then essentially every data point is going to be unique. And so I give you a sample, you learn like a bunch of people's data exactly. So random sampling, you know, sucks from a privacy point of view. However, it is non-interactive. It's local, right? I could just ask each person with certain probability to tell me their data exactly, you know, and if they're chumps enough to participate, they will. And then, but in particular, it allows me to answer some queries, and this is where I said that the order of quantifiers is important. So here's a non-interactive protocol, give a sample, which with high probability over predicates will, I mean, for any predicate I think of at a later date, with high probability I'll get, the sample will allow me to get a good estimate of it. Okay, and somehow, so one could try to interpret the result on some queries as somehow saying, well, listen, of course you can't answer all predicates without describing the entire database. But that's not what's going on. It's really using the kind of definition of privacy in some important way. Because I can actually answer most some queries using, you know, just a handful of points from the database.
Adam?
Yeah.
Maybe I forgot. Are some queries over Z2 or over the reals or something like that?
The sum is over the reals. So how many people satisfy the predicate? How many people have, you know, in this case, either blue eyes or brown hair, but not both?
And in the Goldberg 11 lower bound, maybe I just don't remember, those dot products were over the reals thing also?
Right. I mean, so the Goldberg 11 says that those dot products were, I mean, there was only one point hiding out there. No, those dot products were over GF2. And what I get to see is sort of an individual dot product as opposed to the number of people that satisfy this criterion. So it's, as far as I know, the results are incomparable. Okay, so another way of phrasing that is that somehow if I want privacy and I want the convenience afforded to me by these restricted communication models, then I cannot even simulate the functionality one would get out of a random sample. And the meta claim of this bottom half of the slide is that if you can't get what you can get from a random sample, then you should seriously reconsider what you're doing. And a recent result, and I can say that because of a recent result of Kobe and Sofia Rasodnikov and myself saying something like, centralized interactive protocols in some sense can simulate the randomness, the functionality of a random sample. So if you're willing to move into the Barney purple region, then actually you can sort of get this extra this power. And then it's not that this is a measure of everything you can and should be able to do, but I find it, for my own thinking, a useful nail to hang these concepts on. Okay, so notice for all these arguments, the counting of a single predicate is not actually ruled out. So what I ruled out was counting sort of where there's a different predicate for every person. But what if I'm interested only in things that are predicates satisfied by everyone? And well, you can sort of fiddle around with that, but essentially, that's not going to. I mean, the way I phrased it, it's not ruled out that basically it's not going to work either. There is something else to be said about that, but I won't go into it. but a natural question, obviously, is what about computational security? Well, secure function evaluation certainly circumvents locality, right? And that, as I said, that was sort of spelled out, and they gave some specific, very efficient protocols in a Eurocrypt paper this year. So obviously one can ask, well, what about more efficient solutions than generic secure function evaluation? That is, to some extent, what this paper was about. But it doesn't sort of tell you about interactivity. You know, maybe computational assumptions could get you around interactivity. It would require stronger proofs of what I was claiming. So the claims I made were definitely resided, you know, definitely used the fact that the indistinguishability condition is in information theory. We can ask Yevgeny's question, what if we put in entropy assumptions? This is a natural question both for Yevgeny and myself, because we thought about this in other contexts. And the answer is, it's very tricky here. It's not clear what exactly it buys you. I mean, you can say certain things. It's not clear if they're really meaningful. Once you start assuming specific distributions, maybe you can do things. The answer is, I don't know. It's a big question mark. Another obviously point is, given that we want, you know, interactivity and centralization, suddenly the kind of security challenges go up, because I have to store this data securely. Now, obviously, it's orthogonal to this talk, but it raises the question that, you know, it points out that, of course, if you want privacy, this is somehow inherently tied to security, in the sense that, you know, network security, people think about it. And, of course, there's all the open questions Kobe asked. So there's some kind of big picture emerging of what's going on in this with this style of this type of problem. We've sort of got definitions which we're settling on, basic feasibility results, some separations. But there are, of course, many technical questions still to be answered. A kind of more generic question is, are there other places where this perspective on sort of crypto with non-negligible error, where you're looking at these ratios with a non-negligible epsilon, are there other places where this can help, other than sort of database privacy in the sense that we've been discussing? And I think a natural place to look would be anonymity, mixnets, and this kind of thing, where you know, if you want to defend against traffic analysis, you have to be very careful about what, you know, it's not clear that there are really good non-trivial defenses against traffic analysis, but maybe this type of framework I've been discussing would provide some sort of relaxed way of thinking about the problem.
So crowds, for instance, the analysis already, I guess it's in the context of anonymity.
Yeah, maybe these, they certainly weren't phrased this way, but in the context of anonymity, maybe the crowds, I don't know, I just haven't thought about it. I threw this on the, you know, slide, you know, question marks meaning, I don't know if I know what I'm talking about. Okay. You can, of course, strengthen that statement. So there's some even bigger picture one can ask about it is sort of, well, one type of question, the economic and game theoretic perspective, you know, when are these types of notions actually going to be used? In what situations are self-interested players actually going to insist on privacy? So obviously getting the convenience factor there, getting the technology in place existing is important, but it's not clear it's enough. And there's some sort of interesting work by people like Andrew Lisco and a guy with at CMU with an Italian name, Acquisti, I think, who've been working on this, totally unrelated to our line of work, but I suspect there are some connections. And there's also this question, you know, of course, who decides on the type of level of privacy? But these are way outside the framework of this talk, obviously, but nonetheless important question. You know, can this type of work help other fields? Getting good data is, in general, hard, like instant messaging data, cell phone records, who knows, health data, that kind of thing. So in general, for researchers, it's hard to get access to good data. And what would ideally be great is to kind of arrive at a situation where the people holding the data are convinced that these types of definitions are satisfactory and are willing to give researchers access to very sensitive information, subject to the types of controls we're talking about. And of course, the last bullet is, you know, are there settings where the notion of privacy is totally inappropriate? You know, privacy is such a catch-all phrase. It means so many different things. Certainly, you don't have one notion which satisfies everything, but I don't have a good answer to this question. I just, you know, obviously it's worth keeping in mind that you know, every time you hear the word privacy, the speaker means a slightly different thing, as we saw from the topics of the workshop. So, thanks.